Fargo Bank, N.A.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lori. Well, coming up, we're going to talk about the Publix grocery store chain's big donations to one candidate for governor here in Florida, unprecedented in the company's history. And later, we'll meet a peace activist who works in Bethlehem. But first, four listener comments about last Friday's program. Last Friday, three of our programs, our public affairs shows, dealt extensively with the aftermath of the killings of more than 60 Palestinians last week by Israel and the wounding of thousands more. Here's what four listeners had to say.
Hi, my name is Jim. I'm calling from Brandon. I'm a first-generation American Palestinian, and I just wanted to say that the mainstream media has done such a good job of dehumanizing Palestinians. Just want to say they've done a wonderful job the last few decades of really dehumanizing Palestinians since the time of the PLO. And until people start seeing Palestinians as people, I don't think anything's going to happen. I don't think anybody's going to care.
St. Teeth, I was just listening to the show, actually from Amy Goodman's show. A lot of propaganda, and my point is this. You need to let the other side have some time on this radio station. Eric was right on, and those kids did not know how to answer them. They were fumbling, bumbling, and stumbling. They didn't know how to answer them. The point of it is this, okay? Those kids need to be concerned about Floridians and what's happening in the state of Florida, worrying about what's happening in the Middle East. But the points that Eric brought up, the state of Israel is the reality. Now, if you do a biblical history, okay, and you can get your fact checkers on this, 135 AD, the land was changed to the land of the Philistines or Palestine by the Romans. Now, if you study throughout human history, or through since 606 BC, the Jews were in the land, kicked out of the land, in the land, kicked out of the land, under the times of the political Gentile power, the times of the Gentiles that were still in politically. In my opinion, there is no true Israel until its government is born again and it believes in their king, and we know what his name is. However, God is permitting the situation to be the way it is.
This is Larry at Bradenton. I didn't have time to talk to Summer because she had a guest, so I hope she's listening. When the demonstration started by the fence with the Palestinians, they were peaceful. The media showed their barbecue and being real peaceful. Then all of a sudden, the Israelis were firing upon them, tear gas and dum-dum bullets. But then later on, the Jewish army, they were using live ammo and butterfly bullets, and that's why the Palestinians had the tires up and making a smoke screen so the snipers have a hard time shooting at the demonstrators. But now the media, they avoid that. What they show is the tires and the Palestinians with the slingshot, but they will not show how it all started with the peaceful demonstration.
Ethan from Tampa. I'm calling regarding last week's show, regarding the persons calling in and the discussions about the Israel killing people in Gaza. I totally condemn that. I want to point out two things here. The people that are calling or emailing or contacting you, or even that just listening and they have concerns about this, have they contacted their elected officials in Congress to ask them when they make visits abroad, specifically in the Middle East, if they've gone to Israel as candidates or when elected? Have they gone to Gaza or any Palestinian communities in the West Bank? Hold them accountable, too.
Four listener comments after last Friday's public affairs programs. We're going to have more on that topic later on in the program today. But first, Florida This Week, which is a weekly roundtable program about state and local politics that airs Friday nights and Sunday afternoons on WEDU-TV, West Central Florida's PBS station. And among the topics, the public's donations to political candidate Adam Putnam.
Hi, my name is Jim.
Thank you. Coming up next, Attorney General Pam Bondi files a lawsuit against drug companies over the opioid epidemic. Adam Putnam gets some big help from a grocery store chain in his race for governor. Gubernatorial candidate Chris King stakes out some progressive positions to try to attract more support in the Democratic primary. And Rick Scott and Ron DeSantis take time off from campaigning in Florida to attend the dedication of the new U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem. Political Insights next on Florida This Week.
From the WEDU studios, this is Florida This Week. And now, moderator Rob Lori.
Welcome back. This week, our panelists are Daryl Paulson is a professor emeritus of government at USF St. Petersburg. Mitch Perry is a reporter for WMNF Radio. April Schiff is a political consultant and a Republican. And Rochelle Reback is an attorney and a Democrat. Thank you so much. Great to see you. Well, Florida's Attorney General Pam Bondi announced a lawsuit this week aimed at punishing several major drug manufacturers and distributors contending that they were responsible for pain and destruction and a surge in the opioid overdose deaths. Florida's lawsuit alleges that drug companies misrepresented the dangers of opioid drugs and that distributors were negligent in allowing large numbers of drugs to be sold to the public. An estimated 15 Floridians die every day due to opioids. The lawsuit accuses the companies of racketeering and violating the state's deceptive practices law. It also alleges that drug manufacturers used front groups and paid experts to tout the drugs. The drug companies named in the suit say they are simply following the law and the claims are baseless. Several Democrats faulted Bondi, a Republican, for waiting until the final months of her term in office to file a lawsuit. Hundreds of local governments around the country have already taken drug manufacturers to court over the epidemic. So, Shelley, do you think the Attorney General has a case? Is there a good case to be made that the drug companies downplayed the dangerousness of these drugs?
Well, as your intro stated, hundreds of other municipalities and states have already filed similar lawsuits. Florida is kind of behind the eight ball on this, one of the latest states to take any action.
And why do you think she waited this long?
Oh, I think there's a couple reasons. One is that, you know, we've had a Republican legislature for so long, and Big Pharma has donated a lot of money to the Florida Republican politicians over the years, and I'm sure that that was in some measure responsible for some delay in the lawsuit. The other reason, of course, is it was almost impossible for her to find lawyers willing to take this on. Trial lawyers, for the most part, are Democrats. Republicans favor regulation. Trial lawyers want to hold companies responsible. And in 2010, after the big tobacco litigation, the Republican legislature passed a new law that capped lawyers' fees for this type of big enterprise litigation. And so trial lawyers who work on a contingency basis, meaning they don't get paid unless there's a recovery in the case, didn't want to take on that much work for so small return.
I think of some of the big names in trial lawyering here in the Tampa Bay area. I didn't see their names associated with this case, and that's why.
That's one of the big reasons. And the other reason is, as part of that fee cap, they also changed the law to require that the lawyers who take on this litigation essentially work for the Attorney General. They no longer had the independence that they had in the big tobacco case.
April, there's no doubt that there's a crisis out there, though. I mean, you know, whether or not she did it now or a few months ago or years ago, it's still a good thing, though, to get this ball rolling.
Absolutely, it's a good thing, and it needs to happen because this has to change. There are too many people dying, and it's destroying too many families and lives and businesses, and that the, you know, Big Pharma's profiting off of it. There's examples of sending millions of opioid pills to very small towns to one particular pharmacy. It's ridiculous. And she, I'm sure, decided to do it the right way, to take her time and make sure it was done appropriately, because she is one who is diligent about doing things successfully, and hopefully this will be successful and it'll help quell some of this activity.
And there's no question that she was trying for months. I mean, the RFP went out in January, I believe, to get outside counsel here, and for the reasons you mentioned, she had a hard time getting it. So, you know, that's one reason why she is a little behind some of the other states in pursuing a lawsuit.
Well, let me give you a dissenting voice on all of this in several different respects. I mean, talking about trial lawyers and the poor trial lawyers not being able to survive on their contingency fees. When this was capped in 2010 after the tobacco settlement, which the state of Florida got $11.7 billion, the trial attorneys got $3.4 billion of that fee for working about 2 months for the state of Florida. That in itself is a crime. So because of the reaction to that enormous fee that these trial lawyers got, and I think there were a dozen of them who got $3.4 billion that they split.
Excuse me, there were over 100 of them.
There were 12 major attorneys, yes. Their firms were working on this, but they were hardly in poverty. What the state did, Bill McCollum was attorney general. He pushed this cap on contingency fees. The cap is $50 million. That doesn't count expenses that attorneys can bill. So $50 million to most people is hardly a small amount of money to work with. They did come up with 52 attorneys, different firms that were willing to participate in this. So once again, I think there were enough attorneys there. There were some quite good attorneys who had worked on major suits, including the BP oil spill and the Takata airbag lawsuit. But a different perspective is, you know, Florida always has this reaction, as it does across the country, of just going overboard when it talks about opioids. 15 years ago, doctors were talking about we need pain pills to relieve the burden on people suffering from pain, and we should, you know, administer these pills to these individuals. Now they've gone completely to the other side and said anybody who takes pain pills is an addict. I take pain pills. I have for over 10 years, probably. I've got 7 different incisions. My back looked like a tic-tac-toe board. Certainly, I didn't get those incisions all over my body because I have a love of pain pills, and I want to take pain pills. I take them because I need them, and it helps me to function. So we can never find that middle ground. We're always moving to one extreme to the other, and I think both goals can be accomplished if Florida had some sensible politicians.
Shelley, let me ask you about the mechanics of this. My understanding is that the attorneys who have signed on to this actually don't work for themselves. They work for the attorney general. Is it harder to win a case if you're working under the direction of the attorney general as opposed to coming up with your own legal theory and pursuing the case that way?
Well, I can't speak for the lawyers who have signed on to take the case, but I will say that I can't imagine too many lawyers working on a contingency basis who don't want to control the course of their own work and their efforts to try to be successful. I mean, these are people who, as I said, they don't get paid unless there's a success, a recovery, a financial recovery, and the amount of that recovery will control their fees. So, I mean, I think their independence is really important to them, and that's one of the reasons why it was so difficult to find good lawyers.
What about Daryl's other point? It's capped at $50 million, but that's still a lot of money.
Yeah, and I want to point out, there were hundreds of lawyers involved in the big tobacco litigation, and they all had to split
the $3
billion. The fees.
Probably in poverty with their several hundred million dollars.
No, but the big tobacco lawyers specifically said that they wouldn't work on this case because of the fee caps. So that's preventing them to participate.
In a lawsuit, isn't it pretty typical that if you win big and you're the attorney representing the winning side, that you do get about 30%? Isn't that pretty typical?
That typically has been how it happens.
That is. I mean, yes. If it goes to trial, and if it doesn't, usually 25%. But that, you know, there are circumstances where that can change. But the other thing I just wanted to note in response to what Daryl said about his personal advocacy for pain medication, and I'm not in any way disputing that, but by 2010, the state of Florida doctors were dispensing 10 times as many oxycodone pills than all of the other states combined. And so, you know, while individual cases, there may be terrific rationale for prescriptions for pain medication, overall, taken as a whole, I mean, we had a big problem, and we still have a problem.
Well, there's no doubt about that, but Florida reacted to that problem. I mean, you go back about 7 or 8 years ago, and the one city that they talked about, Hudson, Florida, in Pasco County, a city of about 34,000 people, and that city got 2.2 million opioid pills, enough for 64 pills for every resident. Well, that was in 2011. That was 7 years ago. It doesn't happen anymore because the state reacted to that. It's just like 7 or 8 years ago, of the top 100 doctors prescribing opioids, 98 of the top 100 were from Florida. Well, we've ended the pill mills because of various policies that have been put into effect. And the last time they looked at the numbers, I think it was any of the top 100 doctors prescribing opioids were any longer in Florida. So they've made corrections, but now they're, in my view, going overboard.
Your complaint is that you have to go back to your doctor too many times, even though you're a legitimate patient.
Unless you've had pain pills, you don't know how many times, what you have to go through, how often you have to pee into a cup because they don't trust you. I mean, you'd think after a while that they would get the idea that you've never abused drugs,
That's always a problem when we have abusers of something, no matter what it is, whether it's drugs or other things, guns, anything. If there are people who abuse those, it always comes back to create a hardship on the people who legitimately use those items, whether they're drugs or whatever the items are. And that's what's happened here, is the overreaction has caused a hardship on the people who legitimately need the medication from legitimate doctors.
Shelley, last word.
I want to jump in here because one of the main reasons behind this lawsuit is to recover cost of the fact that the crackdown on pill mills was done without really addressing the public health implications that would cause. And as a result, we have a heroin epidemic now because people who were no longer able to get their oxycodone turned to street drugs like heroin, and now we have people who need drug treatment paid by the state. We have babies born addicted. Their care is paid by the state. We have kids in state-funded foster care. We have all these costs that taxpayers are paying for, which this lawsuit and other similar lawsuits by municipalities are trying to recover because the public health implications were not addressed when they did the crackdown.
All right. Well, the Tampa Bay Times is reporting that Florida's largest private company, the Publix grocery store chain, along with heirs to the Publix family fortune, have donated $670,000 to Adam Putnam's gubernatorial campaign.
It's a show of support that is unprecedented in the history of Florida's largest private company. Both Putnam and Publix are from Polk County, and the company has supported Putnam since he started his political career 22 years ago. But news of the large amount of contributions has caused some problems for the grocery company. Putnam is very close to the NRA, calling himself a proud NRA sellout. But in the aftermath of the Parkland massacre, the NRA is not as popular with the public as it once was. And after some anti-gun violence activists suggested a boycott of the grocery chain, Publix issued a statement to clarify that while it supports Putnam, it does not support the NRA.
So, April, what do you make of the controversy?
It's not, I don't think it's that big of a controversy. I think it's being blown up a little bit. I think that corporations all over the state of Florida support politicians everywhere. It happens all the time. Somebody's always opposed to that, and they have things to say. Publix will weather the storm easily. Putnam, I'm sure, appreciates the support, and I don't think it'll damage Publix one bit. And these things happen. People get excited about stuff, and to draw the connotation that Publix is an NRA supporter because Putnam is supported by the NRA as well is just wrong, but people like to draw those things together and try and make it bigger than it really is.
Mm-hmm. I think this is the conventional wisdom you say, April, and you probably are right. Publix is so ingrained in Floridians, you know, DNA. It's such a popular store. But you mentioned David Hogg and some of the Parkland folks want to boycott Publix. We've seen this on social media. So, Shelley, I saw you put a letter on Facebook. We're seeing a lot of liberals say they're going to boycott Publix. I don't know if that's, you know, if that's going to mean anything. To me, it's like the NFL draft when people said, you know, they can't determine that night who wins. You take a few months. Let's see what happens here. We've seen liberals been successful with going after Fox News personalities like Bill O'Reilly, Laura Ingraham, in terms of hurting their advertisers. There's more of an effort these days to try to hurt companies.
But is Publix being inundated with messages from liberals like Shelley?
Yeah.
Being inundated,
now, whether that matters at all.
I
think messages are one thing, but are people not going to the store? And I don't know if that's true. It's only been 3 days since this has been going on. So I think it's way too early to see if they're being hurt. You're saying they're not going to be hurt. I think that's the general conventional wisdom, is they won't be hurt. I say let's wait a few months, see what if Kroger's and Whole Foods numbers go up and Publix goes down. That would be, to me, the interesting thing to see happens going down if liberals are going to be standing by what they're saying today.
I have to give a shout out to my surly feminists here, who are 5,000 some odd strong just in the local Tampa Bay area, most of whom I should say, are calling for a boycott of Publix. They've all communicated with Publix customer relations department. One of the watchwords right now today is complicit, and Publix issued a tweet indicating that they support Adam Putnam, but they don't support the NRA. But I think one of the things we're seeing in today's political climate is that's the very definition of complicit.
Daryl, is it fair to tie Publix to Adam Putnam and therefore to the NRA?
Well, it's fair if you disagree with that position. I think it's not fair myself. I mean, you can't blame the grocery store if they want to support a particular candidate who comes from their county. They refer to him as the hometown candidate. They're both from Polk County. They've both been around for a long time. We first ran 22 years ago. Publix gave them $500 in a state legislative campaign. The $670,000 you're talking about is money that Publix has contributed to Putnam over the last 3 years. He's raised $22 million in his gubernatorial campaign, so this is a small amount of money. They should be free to support whomever they want. And they also should be free to separate themselves and to say, as they've said, this is for Putnam. It's not because he supports gun control or that he supports the NRA.
Some people point out that Steve Padgett, when he ran for governor, the liberal Democrat, when he ran in 1996 for governor, got to the support of Winn-Dixie, one of the most conservative grocery store chains in the state. But he didn't get nearly $670,000. He got some nice money from Winn-Dixie, but
in that day we didn't have the money in politics that we have today. It's a whole different world, and it's impossible to compare that. Though the Winn-Dixie family, the Davis family, was notorious for supporting conservative causes and conservative politicians, and that's been a common thing in Florida forever. Our big corporations give big money to big politics and big causes that they care about that'll change the face of how they do business or how Florida exists.
And the Coalition of Immokalee Workers has been pushing and going after Publix for years and hasn't really dented in terms of their bottom line. That's true. So that's why I, again, going about, you said originally, that is the conventional wisdom. Maybe it's different now in the age of resistance and Woodrow's being more organized in some ways. I think we still have to wait and see how it goes. But, you know, people assume that Publix is going to be just fine.
Okay, by my count, we've got one vote saying it will hurt Publix, two saying it won't hurt Publix, and we've got Mitch on the fence.
The is wait that the and way? See over there.
Okay. Well, Democratic candidate for governor, businessman Chris King from the Orlando area this week called for ending the death penalty and legalizing recreational marijuana in Florida.
King is trying to stake out a solid left position among the current field of four candidates. King also wants to reduce mass incarceration, saying that he would set a goal of cutting the prison inmate population by 25% over the next 5 years and 50% over the next decade. With the savings, he vowed to use the extra money to support education, child care, and inmate rehabilitation. King has been trying to gain traction against his three better-known rivals, Tallahassee Mayor Andrew Gillum, former Congresswoman Gwen Graham, and former Miami Beach Mayor Phil Levine.
So, Mitch, is this going to help King attract those progressive voters?
Probably can't hurt. You know, he is in third or fourth place in most polls. He himself said it was bold, like, several times. I was at the press of the event in Enoch Davis Center in St. Pete on Tuesday when he said this. Interesting, though. You know, I think, again, the real big headline was about him coming out against the death penalty because that's, like, verboten. I mean, who does that? Democrats nor Republicans usually do. I looked at a poll recently, public policy polling back in 2016 did a poll on the death penalty, 35% said they were totally for it, and 38% said if you had life in prison without parole, restitution to the victims' families, and also you worked in prison, 38% supported that. So I think that maybe the perceptions are that, oh, this is really a radical stance for him. He might get some resonance on this, and he is absolutely, though, trying to put himself out there, get a little more attention. Andrew Gillum and him have been like the two progressives. It's obvious in the four-person race so far. He also came out, you mentioned, the legalization of recreational pot, which at that Fox 13 debate, he did not say just a month ago. I asked him about that. It's like, what happened now? Are you just evolving now? And he says that he wasn't ready to unveil it just at that point, but he's come to that, and he talks about the disparity in terms of blacks and whites being imprisoned or incarcerated because of that as being one of the reasons he's changed his view on it.
He talked about this as part of his Turning the Tide campaign. When you're at 2-4% in the polls, you better turn the tide pretty quickly. So he's got to find something to resonate with the population. He hasn't found it yet, so this is just his latest gambit to propose these, as he called it, big, bold, and progressive ideas. We'll see how well they fly with the public.
On Wednesday, the Washington Post published an analysis list that concluded, and I'm quoting, "The far left is winning the civil war in the Democratic Party." And this was based on the results of recent elections of very liberal candidates, some of them even socialist candidates, in primaries across four states recently. And also, of course, what we've talked about, a shift among Democrats in the era of the Trump presidency. So I say good for King. I hope he drags the rest of them along with him.
But certainly the Republican Party probably is also happy with that analysis. You know, the left takes over the Democratic Party. That will thrill
but
the
April's, at least three of these candidates have picked out a pretty progressive or left-wing position on a lot of issues. I mean, Phil Levine is for a living wage and talking about raising teachers' salaries by $10,000. Yep. I mean, these are all pretty progressive positions. So they're all fighting pretty much over the same turf, I think, except for maybe Gwen Graham.
Well, it's the same in every primary. The Democrats try to paint themselves as far left as possible to get elected in the primary, and the Republicans will paint themselves as far right as possible so they can get elected in their primary, trying to appeal to the base that's going to vote during that election. So, yeah, they are. And he's the underdog. He has to do something. But at the end of the day, in history, Florida has been, the Democrats in Florida have been more conservatives. And so I don't know how that's going to play out Florida. It may play out in other states, as Shelley's saying, but I think that you have to look at your base and what we have here in Florida have always been more conservative Democrats.
Well, also in the Florida Democrats, of course, for years have elected, in terms of gubernatorial nominees, centrists from Tampa Bay who haven't been very successful.
And look how well they've done with that.
Exactly. So that's why, you know, it's interesting, though, again, but King and Gillum in polls are not doing that great, though, right now. You know, so it'll be interesting, right, so far what we see. But, of course, there's more than 3 months to go here, and people maybe aren't focusing yet. They've got a debate in St. Pete in a couple of weeks, and I think that, well, we have to wait and see, I guess.
And you're seeing the attacks on Gwen Graham because they're going to attack the front runner. That's what happens. And I think perception is that she's the front runner at this point. So they're attacking her for anything they can.
Well, and also her record is a more centrist slash conservative than any of the other ones.
But a lot of the polls say Levine is ahead.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, on Monday, as Palestinians in the Gaza Strip were protesting the joint Israeli-Egyptian blockade, two Florida Republican politicians were in Jerusalem, a few miles away, to celebrate the dedication of the new American embassy, which is moving from Tel Aviv.
The split screen was jarring. On the one hand, thousands of Palestinians were seen protesting, throwing rocks, and setting tires on fire, as Israeli gunfire could be heard in the background. While the pictures from the embassy showed a bevy of Americans and Israelis smiling and shaking hands, Congressman Ron DeSantis, who's running for governor, and current governor Rick Scott, who's running for U.S. Senate, were both there.
I think America has to stand strong. This is telling everybody in the Middle East, America is going to stand with Israel. We're going to fight for peace. We all believe in peace. Israel clearly believes in peace. And I think having a strong America that stands for something is going to make sure that is a greater chance that we'll have peace here.
So, Daryl, what are these two politicians who are campaigning right now in Florida doing over there, and does this help their campaign?
They're looking for votes. I mean, the Jewish vote has always been important in Florida. It can make the difference. It has switched back and forth at different points in time. This is Scott's third visit to Israel already. He was criticized by Senator Nelson for abandoning Florida in the midst of a potential storm, which the National Hurricane Center said had about a 30% chance of developing. He criticized Scott for not minding the store at home. He criticized Scott for abandoning his job as governor. And Scott's response, this comes from a man who has been on one taxpayer junket after another, so we can't give much credence to what he has to say. But it's all about votes. You've seen politicians, especially Democratic politicians, going to Puerto Rico. You're seeing other politicians who support Israel, predominantly Republicans, going to Israel because they want to get the backing of their constituent groups, which means money, which also means political support.
One quick last question. That is, there are a growing number of Palestinian Americans and Muslim Americans living here in Florida. They don't seem to be worried, at least Scott and DeSantis don't seem to be worried about that vote.
Are they voters?
Yeah.
Well, that's a good question.
They are in certain parts. You know, there's large Arab populations in certain cities, especially in Michigan and around Flint, Michigan, and around the Detroit area. Certainly every major big city has a large Arab population as well. But when you're looking at this as a whole, candidates are always looking at from the terms of who their supporters are. And for the Republican politicians, They've always lined up as much as possible behind Israel, and the Democrats have been much more closely associated with the Palestinians and their problems and how this is going to have a negative impact on the two-state solution with the opening of the U.S.
But I think it's fair to say that a huge number of voters in South Florida who happen to be Jewish are Democrats.
Thank you.
All
yes.
Right. Okay.
That's not the Jews are not monolithic in terms of their support for Bibi Netanyahu.
There are plenty of Republican Jews around, too.
So. All right. So we're out of time. But before we go, what other news story should we be paying attention to? Mitch,
okay,
let's start with you.
Monday and Tuesday this week, David Jolly, who's a regular presence on cable news, will be even more omnipresent. He and Patrick Murphy are going to be in New York on the cable networks touting, of course, their potential bipartisan race for the Democratic gubernatorial nomination. Of course, they've got four more weeks before they officially have to decide. I think they've got to decide like over the next week or so because the clock is ticking here.
All right, Shelley, you're on the big story.
Yes, John Morgan had some advice for Bill Nelson recently on Twitter. He told him that he should use as a campaign issue the state's intentional bungling of the medical marijuana law situation. And I think it's good advice.
All right, April, you have a big story.
Gina Haspel confirmed as the first woman director of the CIA this week by a Senate vote of 54-45.
Bill Nelson voted for her, angering some
Finally,
Democrats.
Did, yes.
All right. Daryl, you have the big story.
If I was a Democrat, which I'm not, and I'm not a Republican either anymore, but I'd be a little bit worried about the Democratic gubernatorial candidates. You've got Gwen Graham, who started out at 18%, who was down to 9% in the most recent poll, moving in the wrong direction. You've got Andrew Gillum, who's got the support of progressives, but nobody else. You've got Phil Levine, who leads the field at this point in terms of numbers, but it's hard to see how he's going to put together a majority coalition. You've got Chris King, who is the antithesis of Norm Peterson as he walks into tears and nobody knows his name. So he's at 2-4%. So the Democrats have to do something to, I think, develop a following.
All right, they got to get their act together. Thank you all for a great show. We should have more time. Thank you for watching Florida This Week.
Well, that was Florida This Week, which airs on WEDU PBS here in town. And my guests on that show, Daryl Paulson is a professor emeritus of government studies at USF St. Petersburg. April Schiff is active in the Republican Party in Hillsborough County. Shelley Reback is active in the Democratic Party in Hillsborough County. And Mitch Perry is now a part-time reporter for WMNF. And you also hear his program on Midpoint on Thursdays here at 12 noon. Well, you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. Our next guest is Cody O'Rourke, who's an activist. He's here from the city of Bethlehem in Israel. He's been traveling from his native Michigan since 2005 to Palestine, to the Palestinian territories. And since 2012, he has lived in Bethlehem full-time and works for the Holy Land Trust. The Holy Land Trust is a Palestinian nonprofit organization located in the heart of Bethlehem on Star Street. Their work is centered on strengthening communities to empower them to find solutions to problems, solutions which are rooted in social justice, compassion, and love. And Cody O'Rourke, welcome to WMNF. Nice to meet you. Thanks for coming by.
Yeah, thanks for having me here today.
All right, so you're originally from Michigan. How'd you end up in Bethlehem?
Oh, wow. It's really a long story, but to sum it up very quickly, I belong to a Church of the Brethren. The Church of the Brethren is one of the historical peace churches.
Is that a Mennonite church?
It's very similar to the Mennonites. People often confuse us with the Mennonites, and if people don't know what the Church of the Brethren is, sometimes they'll just say, hey, a Mennonite, and that's kind of gets us in the ballpark. But yeah, there was a member of my congregation, Bob Schnepp, who had went on a delegation to Palestine, I think in 2004. He had came back to my church and gave a presentation. I was quite interested in the presentation, and I talked to Bob afterwards and said, wow, Bob, that's really an interesting work that you're doing, being around the Israeli military and providing a little bit of a protective presence for the Palestinians at the checkpoints. And Bob said, well, this is something that you should be involved in. And I said, well, geez, Bob, I don't know much about this stuff, and I sure don't have the money to pack up and go. And Bob said, well, if money is the only problem, then I'll just pay for you. So next thing I knew, I was taken off to Hebron for a 2-week delegation with the Christian Peacemaker teams myself. And after seeing the situation in Hebron, in which you have a Palestinian population of 45,000 you know, in the H2, you know, old city of Hebron being occupied by 400 Israeli settlers and the violence that they endured on a day-to-day basis, I knew that I had to stay involved in trying to understand how I can participate in this conversation.
What do you mean violence on a day-to-day basis?
Well, so Hebron is in the West Bank. It's in the southern West Bank. And it's one of the holiest cities. I mean, not just to to Muslims, but to Jews and Christians as well. And it's the place where Abraham had buried his family members. So there's a Tomb of the Patriarchs or the Ibrahimi Mosque, whichever way you prefer to call it. And so it's very significant to all the three religions. But in Hebron, it's the only Palestinian city in the West Bank in which you actually have Israeli settlements inside of the city. So inside of Hebron, you have approximately 140 different obstacles to Palestinian movements. And what I mean by that is these are military checkpoints in which the roads are closed. These are Palestinian homes whose doors have actually been welded shut, physical blockades put up. And what the Israelis have done in the old city of Hebron is essentially create an area that's been ethnically cleansed of a Palestinian presence. And so you have areas in the old city of Hebron, like Shahada Street, where by simply virtue of you being Palestinian, you are not allowed to walk down that road.
This is in the so-called occupied territory. This is areas that Israel captured in 1967.
Yeah. So right. I just want to make a correction. I don't think referring to it as so-called occupied territories is appropriate. I think we have to say it's a military occupation. Every country in the world, even the United States, the U.S. State Department recognizes that the Gaza Strip, the Golan Heights, East Jerusalem, and the West Bank is under military occupation. Yeah.
The day-to-day violence, so these people are prevented from freely traveling, but when you say violence is a really specific term. Is there violence against the people there in Hebron?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
What kind?
You can have issues. So when we talk about violence, right, there's the layer in which there's the social violence, right? You know, the overt, you know, racism. But then there is also the physical violence. So you have situations in which, because you have Israeli settlers living directly inside of a Palestinian population, you have sometimes confrontations where Israeli settlers will throw stones at Palestinian homes. There'll be pushing matches. You know, sometimes people will get stabbed. But you also have, situations in which the old city of Hebron has also been turned into a military training area, you know, for the Israeli soldiers. So I had lived in Hebron for about 2.5 years working with the Christian peacemaker teams. And where I lived in the old city, I lived directly right next to the Israeli military base. And it would be common for Israeli military soldiers to enter into our offices just as an act of intimidation, even though we are internationals, even though, we're working in a nonviolent and peaceful way. We're an organization that had been there, you know, for over 20 years. And so they're doing that to internationals. And what they're doing to Palestinians in the old city and in different areas of Hebron is twice that worse. You can go in and see them going in and breaking plastic tables, punching holes through the walls. One of the things I think that's most disturbing during my period of time in Hebron is watching Israeli soldiers arrest Palestinian children. I had worked for a period of time with Defense for Children International as one of their advocacy officers. And so what happens is, during that period of time, we had a team of lawyers that would collect affidavits from all of these children in, go in and cross-examine them multiple times over to make sure that, you know, the reports that we're receiving are accurate. Because once you submit a report that's inaccurate, then there goes all of your credibility. But what we come to find out is that over 90% of the Palestinian children that are arrested by the Israeli soldiers receive some form of abuse, whether it's physical abuse, verbal abuse, denied their rights in some capacity. Because what people don't realize is, you know, a lot of times this is framed as, you know, Israelis and Palestinians. And we take a look at the map and we see the Gaza Strip and we see the West Bank. And people think that, you know, the West Bank is all ran by the Palestinian Authority, which that is just factually incorrect. The Palestinian Authority only has administrative powers over 17% of the West Bank, okay? But military law is still applied to 100% of the West Bank. So if you're a Palestinian living inside of Area A, inside of Ramallah, under the Palestinian Authority's jurisdiction, you are still under Israeli military law.
What does that mean day to day?
Wait, so repeat the question. I mean,
what does that mean for the Palestinians day to day if you're living under Israeli military law?
Okay, so let's just take an example of like freedom of speech, right? So say that you're a Palestinian in Ramallah, okay? You're living under Palestinian authority, but you're on Facebook making, you know, comments about the Israeli occupation, Israeli politicians, et cetera, et cetera. Israel can still come in, even into Ramallah, and even though that's an area that's under Palestinian Authority control, take you to court under military tribunal.
Because right? You've been speaking out against the occupation.
Right. So that would be the equivalent of the Canadian government being able to come here. All right.
If they were occupying us.
Yeah.
We're talking with Cody O'Rourke. He's from Michigan, and he's a part of a group called the Holy Land Trust. He is committed to peace and nonviolence. And are you still a Christian peacemaker?
I think if you're with the Christian peacemaker teams once, you're always kind of a Christian peacemaker team worker.
I want to ask about day-to-day conditions in the occupied territories. On the one hand, I've got friends of Israel who send photos to me of how beautiful things are in the occupied territories. Mm-hmm. And then on the other hand, I've got people who say that for the Palestinians, they don't have clean water. They don't have reliable electricity. Mm-hmm. Their calories are limited every day. And that, as you said, their freedom of movement is restricted. So if they're trying to farm their farm or shepherd their sheep, or if they're trying to go to their job, they frequently have to go through several checkpoints. Which is it? Is it a paradise, as my friends who support Israel say, or is it the latter?
Yeah, so... you know, I think when you're talking about any society, you know, there's definitely not one homogenous experience. You know, there's a class system inside of Israeli society, and there's a class system inside of Palestinian society. You know, you have communities inside of you know, the West Bank, in which Palestinians do live, you know, a very luxurious lifestyle. You know, they're owners of big businesses. You know, they have financial resources, et cetera, et cetera. But that's definitely not the typical Palestinian experience in the West Bank, or definitely in the Gaza Strip or in East Jerusalem. You know, like most societies, of course you have an elite class, right? And so I think what's important for us is to acknowledge, the class structure inside of that, right? And so I want to say that both things are true. And I think for us in having these conversations it's about holding that tension. You know, here in the United States, and I draw this parallel, is that, you know, some people will talk about, people of color. And even though that you can be, you know, you see some of these sports athletes, right? And they're still being targeted by the police, even though, you know, they're millionaires and they have nice cars and et cetera, right? And so even though that you are a Palestinian of wealth and you have a certain amount of Palestinian or privileges within inside of Palestinian society, that does not transfer into Israeli society, because at the end of the day, you're still a Palestinian that lives under military law if you are living inside of the West Bank or in East Jerusalem, or the Gaza Strip.
To the point about water, electricity, and calories, what is the water situation for Palestinians in the occupied territories? What is the calorie situation and what is the electricity situation?
Well, I can't speak a lot on the calorie situation. I haven't been working in the health field, but I can speak on to the water situation and to the electrical situation. So Palestinians who are living in what they call Area C, all right, and this is 60% of the West Bank. These are Palestinians who, for their day-to-day lives, administratively, they have to apply to the Israeli Civil Administration for their basic services, whether it's water, it's roads, their electricity. So one of the communities that I work in specifically, it's a Bedouin community south of Hebron, and the community is called Umocher. It's a Bedouin village. They were driven off of their lands in 1948 from the Negev. They came in and bought this land from the Palestinian community of Yatta in 1964. You know, there's no dispute over the ownership of their land. So I want to be clear about that. Even the Israeli government acknowledges that they have ownership of this land. But in the 1980s, the Israeli settlement of Carmel was established right next to this Palestinian community of Umocher. The Israeli settlement next door has all the electricity, has all of the water, okay? Their chickens next door, the water pipes literally run over the Palestinian property to supply water to the chickens. The chickens have air conditioning during the summertime, whereas my buddies Tariq, Aid, and Audi, they a lot of times don't even have enough water to water their gardens or to take showers. They don't have they have some solar panels inside of their communities, but even their solar panels can be confiscated because they need to have permits to have those solar panels inside of their communities.
So the solar panels can be taken away. This idea, international law says that when a country occupies another country, that the country that occupies has to give equal rights of citizenship to the people that it's occupying. How would you describe the rights of Palestinian people living in the occupied territories? Do they have any sort of equal rights to the Israeli citizens?
No, I mean, absolutely not. You know, it's... So I want to be clear. I mean, just because you're occupying a country, that doesn't necessarily mean that you have to give them citizenship. You know, what you have to do is you have to provide them with, you know, the basic necessities of life. You know, and they're not doing that. You know, one of the things that people oftentimes talk about is that under the Fourth Geneva Conventions, you're not allowed to transfer your own population into the area that you're occupying. Okay, because when you do that, you're creating a system of colonization, and that's what Israel has done. And so, inside of the West Bank, you know what you have now is about 750,000 settlers living in 130 different recognized settlements by the Israeli government. And what I say by recognize is that the Israeli government has sanctioned the development of those settlements, right? They're connected, they get government resources, et cetera, et cetera.
Are these temporary facilities?
No, absolutely not. I mean, these are huge, you know, condominium projects. I mean, in some of these settlements, you have hundreds and thousands of people, like in Malia Demim and Ariel, that expand, you know, deep into the what? These are cities, you know, with roads, movie theaters, shopping malls. I mean, it looks, they're better developed than this little community that we're living in right now.
Than East Tampa. All right. Cody O'Rourke is an activist. He's lives in Bethlehem. He's from Michigan. He travels back and forth between Michigan and Bethlehem. He's part of the Holy Land Trust, which is a Palestinian nonprofit organization located in the heart of Bethlehem. And it is committed to social justice, compassion, and love, and nonviolence. Cody, I want to ask you, last week, as the Palestinian protests were going on, I read in Haaretz that there was a protest in Tel Aviv in which people were objecting to the shooting of Palestinians, the shooting of the demonstrators. We often don't hear that there are Israelis who are pro-peace, but did you hear about this demonstration last week in Tel Aviv, and could you talk about your experience about Israelis that object to the way the Palestinians are treated?
Yeah, Rob. I'm happy to talk about that. And that's something that I take very seriously. With me being the father of an Israeli Jew, I'm all the time thinking about how does my parenting, come into this? And I'm lucky to have, an Israeli family that supports me wholeheartedly in this work. And in fact, my father-in-law, Jeff Helper, who's the executive director of the Israeli Committee Against Home Demolitions, he was nominated, for the Nobel Peace Prize in the early 2000s. My son's mother, she was a refusenik. And what that means is that she was an Israeli, citizen who refused to join the Israeli military. My son's two uncles, Yishai and Yair, they both refused to join the military. The night before I flew here, I wasn't at the protest in Tel Aviv, but my son and my son's mother and I, we was all in a protest in Jerusalem, to show some solidarity as, Israeli citizens for what's going on in Gaza, what's going on in the West Bank, and what's going on inside of East Jerusalem. Now, Rob, we're in a pretty progressive community, and I think this is a pretty progressive, probably, radio station. And I think what's hard for me, myself, is that, protests are only one component of social change. And so what I'm telling my Israeli counterparts, my Jewish counterparts, my Christian counterparts, even my Palestinian counterparts, that if we think that going up and showing to a protest is enough, you're on the wrong ship. You're on the wrong ship, because that ship is not going to sail us to justice. We need real sacrifice. It's not a sacrifice for me to show up for an hour and hold a sign, right? I need to be talking to my legislators. I need to be making financial commitments to the communities that are living under oppression that don't have the resources. I have to put my physical body on the line, right? And so what I'm saying is, and what I'm saying to the other, to my other Israeli and Jewish colleagues, is that you have privileges and rights enshrined to you that your Palestinian partners who are living under military occupation simply do not. And you need to put those privileges on the line if you are serious about justice.
This idea of using peace and nonviolence, I think a lot of times as the people who live in the Palestinian territories and the occupied territories are portrayed, they're portrayed as being violent people by some media in this country, that mm-hmm. they're all violent. What's your sense about how important is nonviolence to the Palestinian people? Have some of them embraced it? Have all of them embraced it? Or, what's the range of people who've embraced nonviolence as a way to protest the Israeli occupation?
Yeah, I mean, when you look at the opinion polls that Conrad Adenauer and the Palestinian Bureau of Statistics put out, on a quarterly basis, the violent struggle and nonviolent struggle, the majority of Palestinians support nonviolence. And it's for various reasons. That they support it. I definitely think that it's not fair to say that all Palestinians support the armed struggle. And I think that there's a difference between a person. I want to be careful here in how I say this. There's a difference between a person whose homes had been destroyed three or four times by the Israeli military, whose brothers had been shot and killed, who simply does not have a future in front of them, and they commit an act of violence. That's something that's completely different than a politician calling for violence, right? And so I think one of the things, and that's not to condone violence, right? But I think it's to understand that some of these situations that the Palestinians are living under, like in the situation with Gaza, you have 2 million people living in the Gaza Strip. It's been sealed off from all sides. The Israeli military controls what goes in and what goes out. They have electricity that's rationed out during the day. Their drinking water is literally not even drinkable because there's so much raw sewage from the years and years of bombing. Unemployment rate is astronomically high. You are dealing with people that have no foreseeable future. I mean, you know, there's been a report that's been issued that says Gaza is in a state of de-development. And this is the third most populated, densely populated city in the world. And when you have no hope in your life, right, I think it's reasonable to do things in which demonstrate you are hopeless, right?
Well, Cody, we're out of time. If people want to find out more, John writes from Port Richey, says, is there a good documentary that people could watch about the reality of living in the Palestinian territories?
Oh, wow. You know, there's so many of them. I couldn't, you know, Five Broken Cameras and the Struggle of Baleen, that's a good one, because that talks a lot about, you know, Palestinian nonviolent struggle.
Stone's Throw Away is another one. I don't know if you've seen that yet.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Do you have a website?
You can go to, I would recommend a couple of websites.
We only have 20 seconds. Please.
Okay. The Israeli Committee Against Home Demolitions, ICAHD.org, HolyLandTrust.org, and you can also go to Defense for Children International Palestine.
All right. Cody O'Rourke, thanks a lot. Part of the Holy Land Trust. If you want to comment about today's show, please call us up at 813-238-8001. Record your comment on extension 115. We'll play those comments back to